inviting me. This has been really fun. I really, really like conferences that have philosophers and psychologists side by side, because then I really get to learn a lot from the psychologists. I mean, I've been around in philosophy long enough that I feel like I've seen a lot of what's going on in philosophy, but from the psychologists, I still have a lot to learn. I hope that the talk will speak to people coming from different angles. I mean, I am a philosopher, so this isn't essentially a philosophical talk, but it has a slight empirical component, so hopefully it will be of interest to everyone. And I'll be talking about metaphors for argumentation, and after me there will be Ian coming up and saying that I'm wrong on almost everything that I'm saying now. We've done this dual thing a couple months ago in Munich, so I gave the talk first, and then he says, oh, you know, basically everything she said I disagree with, which is fun. So, you know, you see when it comes. Right. Also, yes, a bit of self-promotion. This is a talk based on ideas for my next research project, and until recently it was still pending on funding going through. And about 10 days ago, I heard that funding had gone through. So I will be able to. Until now, it was always like, oh, you know, if the DRC gives me money, I'll get to actually work on these ideas. But now I can say, even though the official letter hasn't come in yet, so I'm not supposed to Twitter and Facebook about it, but I can share it with people. And I'm still always kind of really worried that they're going to send me an email saying, actually, it was a mistake. We apologize. So far, so good. Anyway, so let's go to work. So I also have to say, I'll be taking, although this of course is a conference on public discourse more generally, I'll be looking specifically at the way debates and discourse unfolds in philosophy as a kind of like a special case study. And I think that a lot of the points that I'll be making about debates and philosophy also apply more generally to public discourse. So it's kind of like a special case study, which I think then generalizes more to other contexts. And so one of the starting points is that for the non-philosophers among you may not know, but the philosophers will have followed that there's been a lot of discussion recently on the presumed combative, overly combative nature of philosophy. People talk about it in blogs and in papers and so forth. And this is seen certainly in seminars, adversarial interaction in seminars and lectures. And Alessandra was talking about this idea of the scorekeeping system. You know, if a speaker comes to an institution to give a talk, and then it's us versus the speaker and see who wins. And one of the suggestions that has been made is that this combative nature of philosophical practice might be one of the reasons why we have so few women philosophers. So philosophy has the lowest gender balance in all of the humanities. We're together with engineering and physics, so that's kind of worrisome and weird. And as this has been put forward, I don't agree with this, so just mentioning it. And many people think that it's such a bad thing that philosophy is so combative. And other people think that actually it's, let me just let people stop. It's at the essence of philosophy, so there's no changing that. And so people who don't like the combativeness of philosophy, they just should just go do something else. Maybe be, you know, I don't know, literary critics or something. And this has been a discussion particularly with respect to, from feminist perspective. So there's a classical paper by Janice Moulton called The Adversary Method in Philosophy. I forgot the exact title, but that's what it was about. And there, so this she criticizes quite strongly this way of doing philosophy in an adversarial combative way. Other people, for example, Louise Anthony, have pointed out that the liberating value of gender transgression when women appropriate aggressiveness. So, you know, that's kind of more where I am. Just let me put my cards on the table. I think that, you know, we need to appropriate and reinvent adversariality. But it remains a point of discussion also among feminist philosophers, how to, you know, what are the parameters for respectful disagreement? And so how can you how can you disagree in a way that's respectful and productive? So these are meta-philosophical questions, but then again, they carry over to other situations of debate. And so ultimately, what we're talking about here is the concept of argumentation, and it really hinges on how we are to understand both the concept and the practice of argumentation. And so the question becomes, is argumentation inherently coercive? Is this really, you know, inherent to argumentation to be coercive? And so whenever argumentation is being used, it's inevitable that there will be this component, or are there alternative ways to think about argumentation that would kind of help us move away from this overly combative model? And here I quote Daniel Cohn, who has already been mentioned before, in this paper called Argument as War, and War, I forgot the title, I'm really forgetting the title today. It's a really good paper though. And he says, what we need are not new definitions, but new metaphors. And Ian will say in a while that what we need is not new metaphors, but new interpretations of the existing metaphors. But I don't want to, you know, steal your thunder too much. So this is what I'll say. I'll discuss a couple of different metaphors for argumentation that are current. And actually, three of them are not by me. And the final one is the one that really is the basis of this new research project that I was telling you about. So let's start with argument as truth conduce, right? So that there's something very good about argumentation, and that it actually brings us closer to the truth. And I think Eureka was talking about some of these ideas just before the break. So it's often said that one of the primary functions of an argument is to enhance the acceptability of the speech act for which it is an argument. That's kind of, in a way, the essential function of it. And for this to happen, the proponent of an argument should offer epistemic justification for the conclusion of the argument. Right? So the premises offer justification for the conclusion. And the idea is that this process of exchanging epistemic justifications should lead to higher accuracy. So again, back to the concept that Lurica was talking about, because by doing this, you weed out the fact of justification, right? By putting it up to scrutiny by your peers, by doing, you know, this collective process of examining reasons should lead us closer to the truth and should lead us should allow us to get rid of unjustified false beliefs. And there is quite a lot of empirical evidence by, for example, Hugo Mercier, also formal evidence by this guy called Gregor Betz, who has these very interesting simulations of argumentative situations, also based on a Bayesian framework. These are very kind of results that would make you feel optimistic about the power of argumentation. It does seem to increase the truth conduciveness of that particular epistemic process. And then, of course, we remain with the question of whether the practice is inherently adversarial. So I think in the interest of time, I'm probably going to skip this quote, but just so that to say that this idea that dissent and disagreeing with each other is a good thing epistemically, it's an old idea. And one of its main proponents was John Stuart Mill. And here I have a quote by Nigel Warburton on a general piece, not a philosophical, not a scholarly piece, where he talks about this, right? So Mill said, you know, it's very good for us to be challenged in our opinions, and so we need to, you know, even if someone, right, so towards the end, dissenters are of great value even when they are largely or even totally mistaken in their beliefs, because they force you to scrutinize your beliefs and find good justifications for them. Right, so that's kind of like on the rosy side of things, right? Argumentation, good stuff, truth conducive. But of course, that's not all of it. And I already hinted at some of that at the beginning. So here we have the cover of a very influential textbook on argumentation theory by the Amsterdam School, as it's known, Pragma Dialectic Amsterdam School. What do you think of it? I mean, is this giving you, is this a good way to sell argumentation in the sense of like, oh, it's an interesting practice? So I find this really deplorable. And So this is the argument as war metaphor, it's the argument as fight, as zero-sum game metaphor. And this one, and you can see why, even from the previous story, the truth conduciveness story, why you might get into this picture, the argument as war picture. So first of all, argumentation presumably starts with a situation of disagreement, right? Or at least of epistemic differences. If you don't disagree with each other, there's usually no point in engaging in a process of argumentation. So arguer wants to defend claim P and offers reasons that support acceptability of P. Addressee is not initially inclined towards accepting P, but then, given these reasons, might or might not be then convinced to then change her beliefs with respect to P. And in this way, you could see that a process of argumentation can easily become a competition between the two interlocutors, because they seem to have opposite goals, right? So arguer wants to establish P, wants to get addressee to accept P, and addressee wants to block the establishment of P, right? Wants to say, no, I'm not convinced by P. So it seems that they have opposite goals, and so it seems that the adversarial component is inherent
to argumentation. Here I have a quote which I think is from the Moulton's paper, Nozick, a very influential philosopher, and which I think really summarizes nicely what a lot of philosophers take to be good philosophical argumentation. Wouldn't it be better if philosophical arguments had left the person no possible answer at all, reducing him to impotent silence? Even then, he might sit there silently, smiling Buddha-like. Perhaps philosophers need arguments so powerful that they set up reverberations in the brain. If the person refuses to accept the conclusion, he dies. How's that for a powerful argument? Right? So you want an argument to be a killing machine, right? Of submission, a machine of submission. So that's where I hope you find it. I mean, I find this worrisome. So you see a lot of what one way to see the pervasiveness of the war metaphor is the pervasiveness of belligerent vocabulary with respect to argumentation. So things like, right, philosophers are trained to find objections, counterexamples, rebuttals, and to what their interlocutor says, and the interlocutors are often described as the opponents. Even that, right? So in this terminology, proponent, opponent, you already see this idea of adversariality. So argumentation is a duo, and only one of them can win. So it's a zero-sum game, and there's also there are all kinds of procedures for scorekeeping to see who scored a point there or not. And so all the things that are often said, the winning person will crush the opponent or will stick to their guns, their lines of attack and argumentation, their counterattacks, their winning strategies, their defensible positions. So it all sounds very warlike, right? The kind of vocabulary that's used. So that's it for war, the argument as war metaphor. Right? So all I want to have established for now is that this is a pervasive way to think about argumentation, and at least to some extent, problematic, okay? So what are the alternatives, right? You might think, well, that's it, right? That's all there is to it. So one alternative that has been developed to some extent in the literature is argument as therapy, okay? And this goes back to Socrates, who has already been mentioned a couple of times. And Socrates, in his better days, in his last as holy days, he actually had, his practice reflected some sort of concern with respect to the well-being of the interlocutor, right? But he actually saw himself as a midwife. Some people already have their true beliefs, the true beliefs in them. Actually, so that's Plato, of course, as well as Socrates himself. And these just need to be brought to light. And Socrates sees himself as providing this particular service. So he says, my white of midwifery is in general like theirs, the real midwives. The only difference is that my patients are men, not women. Yeah, because, women, there's no debating with them. And my concern is not with the body, but with the soul that is in travail of birth. And the highest point of my art is the power to prove by every test whether the offspring of a young man's thought is a false phantom or instinct with life and truth. The many admirable truths they bring to birth have been discovered by themselves from within. But the delivery is heaven's work and mine. Right, so this is the idea, the theory of recollection. So we have Plato's idea that we already have knowledge of all true things in us. It's just that it needs to be discovered, right? Brought from within. So this would be one way, and by engaging in a situation of argumentation, in fact, to provide this service of actually helping someone, providing treatment for the ailments that they suffer from, namely holding false beliefs. And then other things that Socrates says elsewhere in other dialogues, he says, for example, in the Gorgias, he says, be a friend to me, refute me, purge me of these false beliefs. So you're doing a favor to someone when you're arguing with someone and exposing their false beliefs, you're actually doing them a favor, right, by treating them in this way. And what's interesting, I mean, there are a number of interesting things with respect to this way of thinking about argumentation as therapy. One of them is that some amount of unease and pain will typically be associated with this treatment, right? So just as befits genuine medical treatment. So that seems right, right? It's not exactly pleasant to be proven wrong. Right? There's some amount of irritation that comes with it. But at the same time, isn't that also the case for most medical treatments for physical illnesses? And so I do think there are a number of interesting things with respect to this metaphor of argumentation as therapy. But there's one thing I really dislike about it, which is that it has its paternalistic component. Right? So
there's the healer and the patient. So there's this strong asymmetry between the two participants in a situation of argumentation, whereas in the previous one, in the war metaphor, at least they weren't apart to start with. Okay? And here we have this asymmetry built inside the metaphor, and I think that that's also something that doesn't really, I mean, doesn't give us the kind of picture of argumentation that we would like to have. Right, so that's for the existing metaphors that other people have developed or either implicitly or explicitly endorse. And now I move on to my own story. Right, so here, so the argument as epistemic social exchange is not so much of a metaphor, it's really a way to conceptualize argumentation based on a particular theory, social exchange theory, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And so it's a reconceptualization of argumentation, which also leads to specific predictions, empirical predictions, and hopefully also to recommendations on how to optimize processes of argumentation. So my inspiration for this, I think I have time. We start at 20, right? So I've been speaking for 17 minutes. Okay, I'm going well for time. So I can spend some time on this. My initial inspiration for this idea comes from a paper by Kenny Esrahan, who's an epistemologist, but back then he was doing a lot of philosophy and mathematics. And so this really relates to my previous research project on deductive reasoning and argumentation, specifically with respect to mathematical proofs. So that's how I got into this, into this new world, so to say. And so he, in this paper, he's talking about what distinguishes probabilistic mathematical proofs from classical Euclidean mathematical proofs. Right? So he was responding to someone else, Don Fallis, who had said, actually, epistemically speaking, there aren't very big differences between probabilistic proofs and classical Euclidean proofs. And Kenny is here trying to, you know, spot the difference, put his finger on what it is that's different about mathematical, classical Euclidean mathematical proofs. And so he says the following. The basic idea is that a proof must be such that a relevant expert will become convinced of the truth of the conclusion of the proof just by consideration of each of the steps in the proof. With non-transferable proofs, because that's how he calls this property, right? So the property of transferability that classical proofs have, with non-transferable proofs, something extra beyond just the steps in the proof is needed. In the case of probabilistic proofs, this extra component is a knowledge of the process by which the proof was generated, and in particular that the supposedly random steps really were random. Right? So he says that classical Euclidean proofs have the property of transferability, right? That you can actually transfer your belief in the conclusion to someone else just by giving this person your reasons for believing P. And specifically with respect to mathematical proofs, this is exactly the game. This is what you do. And he claims that probabilistic proofs don't have this property of transferability. So that's what's different. And so this paper got me thinking about how to generalize this idea of transferability beyond mathematical proofs. And so this is really how my research project emerged, by thinking about how to apply this general idea also outside of mathematics. And so, by the way, the title of the project is The Social Epistemology of Argumentation. So it really is an epistemological project. I am very interested in epistemological dimensions of argumentation, including things like accuracy and other justification, etc., etc. But it's a project in social epistemology. So I'm interested, very much interested in how processes, these epistemic processes, take place in a social environment. Okay? So this is just the starting point, as I told you. And as I was trying to find a way to conceptualize this idea of transferability, of transferring something to someone else, I came across this framework called social exchange theory, and speaking to some of the psychologists here yesterday over dinner, they said, oh yeah, I'm totally familiar with it. But I assume that most of the people coming from philosophy may not have heard about it. So it's a framework which was from sociology and social psychology, which started kind of in the 1960s, has been quite active since, and it's used for a number of different things. More recently, it's been specifically to look at romantic relationships. So that's quite interesting. And the framework, what it does is that it explains patterns of social interaction as processes of negotiated exchanges, which involve costs and rewards. So the framework does have an inspiration from kind of classical decision theoretical notions, But at the same time, right, so there is this idea of maximizing your own, you know, your own rewards. But at the same time, it also is very much based on the idea of interdependence, where we very much depend on each other to survive as humans. And so this idea for this, interplay between interdependence and self-interest is kind of at the core of the framework. And I thought that's kind of interesting for me here. Because basically what I want to, I want an account of argumentation which will give a rationale both for the arguer and for the addressee to participate in this process. And I think Burica was also saying things along these lines. What's in it for me to actually be the receiver of an argument, right? If it's only about the arguer, you know, just telling bullocks and getting me to do whatever the arguer wants me to do, it doesn't seem that there's any motivation for me to engage in this process. And I thought, wow, that doesn't explain the practice. And certainly doesn't explain it in a way that makes it attractive. And so I wanted to emphasize this idea that, that there are mutual benefits in engaging in argumentation, and then I thought that this framework of social exchange theory could do that for me. What else do I have? I have more on, I think a little bit more on social exchange theory. And one of the main principles of the whole framework is this idea that a successful exchange consists in giving others something that's more valuable to them than it is costly for you to give. So per saldo, we're all better off. That's the idea, right? Per saldo, together, you know, you'll be better, you know, your netto gain by actually receiving these resources will be greater than the loss that it is for me. And so in this sense, this is how I want to think about argumentation, that, right, so that there will be this netto gain for us taken together. And just one thing about, a general thing about social exchange theory is that it theorizes about different kinds of resources, right? So it talks about goods, status, affection, services, and also information. And so it can be, it lends itself quite well also for the analysis of the exchange of epistemic resources, or so I think. And what I'm interested in specifically is the exchange and co-production, by the way, also of epistemic resources by means of argumentation, right? So this is what I want to do. All right, so then just, again, this is a programmatic talk, right? So these are all ideas that, fortunately, now I have 5 years to work on. And so, but at least for now, I hope it's concrete enough so that you think, well, okay, there's potential there. So in a situation of argumentation, epistemic resources such as knowledge and evidence, justification, critical objections, defeaters, etc., can be exchanged, right? So by and again here the general principle that ideally will be more rewarding for the receiver to receive the resources than it is costly for the giver to give. And what arguer does is to offer addressee the epistemic ground needed to support a conclusion. These are epistemic resources because they're justifications. And addressee may challenge what arguer is saying, and so defeaters, as it's known in epistemology, are also epistemic valuable epistemic resources. And by doing this, right, by doing this together, the process may lead to an epistemic gain for both parties, and as they scrutinize the reliability of the piece of information together. And so this is very important for me, because remember that there was an argument as war metaphor, which saw argumentation as a zero-sum game. There will be a winner, there will be a loser. And what I want to say is that if you think about argumentation in this way, we can both be winners, right? We can both be better off. And argumentation can also lead to the co-production of new epistemically valuable items. And this is most clearly seen in what has been described in mathematics specifically. And here is that for the mathematicians, so the philosophers of all of you, Proofs and Refutations, this wonderful book by Lakatos, which describes exactly the kind of back and forth between different people. And somebody puts forward a conjecture and a tentative proof, right? And somebody else puts forward objection, which leads to an improvement over the proof, etc., and that keeps going. So for Lakatos, there's no end to this process, by the way. But either way, this is how mathematical knowledge is produced on this Lakatosian picture, and I think it's a perfect illustration of the kind of thing I'm trying to capture here. So if that's what you write, so this is what I want to achieve, both in theory and in practice. But of course, immediately you see that virtues will become an important component of the story. So the likelihood of fruitful argumentation will of course increase if parties adopt specific behaviors and attitudes. And this is also that's been widely studied in the social exchange literature, that there are conditions for successful social exchange that need to be in place, right? And the particular attitudes that people are well advised to adopt if they want the social exchange to be successful. And one of the things that people have discussed in the social exchange literature is trust, reciprocity, and a number of other virtuous components, so to say. So one of them, for example, something also that's been mentioned by other people, is that arguer must look for reasons that are likely to be compelling to addressee. There's no point in arguer offering the reasons that are compelling to her arguer and just, you know, hammering them on addressee. That's not going to be very successful. So there's this idea of, you know, taking the perspective of the other, at least to some extent. I take that to be a virtue. We talked also a lot about this in other talks. But on the part of addressee should also be willing to receive these epistemic resources in the spirit of openness. So openness, and even if there's a clash with addressee's initial beliefs. And so what you have here is the willingness to listen, which is something that Dan Cohen, who has also been mentioned before, has been writing on recently. And the virtue of listening is very important for the process of argumentation to be successful. And this is specifically important in situations of scarce common ground. And of course, we're interested in exactly these situations of scarce common ground. For example, the discussion on climate change, although, as Liv showed yesterday, there's more common ground than you might think, just prima facie, which is, I guess, encouraging. And again, trust being a fundamental component. And I think that this is one of the things that I want to work out in my project, because this is not something that's usually associated with argumentation. It's something that's associated with testimony, right? That the source, the credibility of the source is really important. And at least in the philosophical literature, there's often the presupposition that the argument should speak for itself, that it shouldn't be about the source. And I think that's very wrong. I think that's misguided, that's mistaken. And the way in which social exchange theory emphasizes the importance of trust, I think will be a very useful way for me to make a case for the importance of trust also in argumentative situations. Right, I'm just almost finishing, so that's a little time. But there are issues, right? So this all is all very fun, and it seems all kind of optimistic in the sense that a lot of the issues that we identified with the argument as war metaphor seem to be dealt with. Also, argument as therapy, also we seem to have gotten better because now we have symmetrical positions for the two participants. But there are a number of issues, obviously. Otherwise, why would I spend 5 years working on this? So one of the issues that I'm very interested in is how epistemic resources can be transferred through argumentation across different standpoints. So one of the things that people also talk about in philosophy these days is standpoint theory, not only these days. It's an old idea, but it's made a comeback. If you have very, very different epistemic standpoints, is it even possible to engage in this process of exchanging epistemic resources, given that you're coming from such different places? And I'm hoping it is, and I'm trying to, and one of the things I want to do in the project is to find ways to facilitate the process of people coming from very different standpoints to actually engage in these fruitful exchanges. And another question that I'm really interested in is if there are forms of epistemic injustice, which is again a very popular concept in philosophy and epistemology these days, whether there are forms of epistemic injustice that pertain specifically to argumentation, right, which we might call argumentative injustice, which would hinder the exchange of epistemic resources through argumentation. And one of the things that people talk about in the literature on epistemic injustice is, for example, credibility deficits, right? So if there's a particular person who's seen as not credible because on account of things like race and gender and class and ability, et cetera, which are not epistemic factors, so they shouldn't matter, and yet it does affect their credibility. And so I'm interested in looking at how these power dynamic effects might also affect processes of argumentation. So if people just don't listen, right? So if there's someone who's just trying to make a point there, but people are just not listening, and how to potentially, so first of all, to identify these phenomena, if there are such phenomena, and secondly, to try to find ways to perhaps address these problems in argumentative situations. Okay, so to conclude, I have argued that the war metaphor is problematic for a number of reasons, both moral and epistemic, and Ian will be agreeing with me in a minute, which is fun, as I said. And I also said that the therapy metaphor has advantages, right, because it also emphasizes this idea of improving your beliefs,
but it doesn't attribute the right kind of agency to all the participants, and it also has this asymmetry between participants. And the epistemic exchange approach that I want to further develop emphasizes the potential epistemic gains of the process. So in this sense, I am going back to the truth conduciveness idea of argumentation. I want to show that, you know, argumentation can really have this epistemic beneficial effect. So I'm not dishing this idea at all. In fact, to the contrary. But I want to place this idea of truth conduciveness in the social, against the social background that I take to be essential for discussion of human knowledge. So human knowledge, human cognition are essentially social phenomena, and what I think is often missing in the people thinking about argumentation only from this epistemic perspective of truth conduciveness is the social component that I think is also essential. And so this is what I'm trying to do here, is to combine on the one hand this epistemological view of argumentation with a social, an inherently social way to think about argumentation and how it fosters these processes, these social processes of exchange of epistemic resources, of circulation of epistemic resources. So this is what I have for today. Thank you.